bitter and thus have made the correct assumption. Here's a way of demonstrating that you should always bid as if you've won. Imagine that you have a confederate inside the auction house. The confederate has the ability to adjust your bid downward in the event that you have the highest bid. Unfortunately, he doesn't know the other bids and can't tell you precisely how much to lower your bid. And if you don't have the highest bid, there's nothing he can do to help you. Would you want to employ his service? You might not because it is unethical. You might not because you are afraid of turning a winning bid into a losing bid. But play along and imagine that you are willing to use his services. Your original bid was $100, and after learning that this was the winning bid, you instruct him to lower the bid to $80. If this was a good idea, you might as well have bid $80 right from the start. Why? Let's compare the two cases. Case A. Bid $100, lower bid to $80 if $100 was highest. Case B. Bid $80. If $100 would have lost, then there's no difference between bidding $100 or $80. Both would be losing bids. If $100 would have won, then your confederate would lower the bid to $80, in which case you will end up in the same place as if you had bid $80 all along. In short, there is no advantage to bidding $100 and then reducing it to $80 when you've won, compared to bidding $80 from the start. Since you can get the same result without having the confederate and acting unethically, you might as well bid $80 from the start. What this all says is that when you are thinking about how much to bid, you should pretend that all of the other bidders are somewhere below your bid. Armed with this assumption, you then consider your best bid. We'll return to figuring out just how much to bid after making a short detour to the Netherlands. Dutch auctions. Stocks are traded on the New York Stock Exchange. Electronics are sold in Akihabara, Tokyo. Holland is where the world goes to buy flowers. At the Alsmeer Flower Auction, the auction house takes up 160 acres. On a typical day, some 14 million flowers and a million potted plants change hands. What makes Alsmeer and other Dutch auctions a bit different from Sotheby's is that the bidding goes in reverse. Instead of starting with a low price and having the auctioneer call out successively higher prices, the auction starts with a high price that declines. Imagine a clock that starts at 100 and then winds down to 99, 98. The first person to stop the clock wins the auction and pays the price at which the clock was stopped. This auction is the reverse of the Japanese auction. In the Japanese auction, all of the bidders indicate their participation. The prices keep rising until only one bidder is left. In the Dutch auction, prices start high and fall until the first bidder indicates his or her participation. If you raise your hand in a Dutch auction, the auction stops and you've won. You don't have to go to the Netherlands to participate in a Dutch auction. You could send an agent to bid for you. Think for a moment about the instructions you might give your agent. You might say to wait until the price of petunias falls to 86.3 euros, and then bid. As you contemplate those instructions, you should anticipate that if the bidding ever gets down to 86.3 euros, then you will be the winning bidder. If you were at the auction house, you'd know that all the other bidders have yet to act. Armed with this knowledge, you don't want to change your bid. If you wait a moment longer, one of the other bidders might jump in and take your place. Of course, that is true all along. Anytime you wait, another bidder might jump in. The issue is that the longer you wait, the bigger the profit you risk losing. And the longer you wait, the greater the risk that one of the other bidders is about to jump in. At your optimal bid, the savings from paying a lower bid is no longer worth the increased risk of losing the prize. In many ways, this is similar to what you might do in a sealed bid auction. The instruction you give your bidding agent is akin to what you would write down as your sealed bid. Everyone else does the same. the person who writes down the highest number is the same as the person who first raises his or her hand. The only difference between a Dutch auction and a sealed bid auction is when you bid in a Dutch auction, you know you've won. When you write down your bid in a sealed bid auction, you only find out later if you've won or not. But remember our guidance. In a sealed bid auction, you are supposed to bid as if you've won. You're supposed to pretend that all of the other bidders are somewhere below you. This is exactly the situation you are in when competing in a Dutch auction. Thus, the way you bid in the two auctions is identical. Just as an English auction and a Vickrey auction end up in the same place, so do a sealed bid auction and a Dutch auction. Since participants bid the same amount, the sellers get the same amount. Of course, that doesn't yet tell us how much to bid. It just says that we have two mysteries with the same answer. The answer for how much to bid comes from one of the most remarkable results in auction theory, the revenue equivalence theorem. It turns out that when the valuations are private and the game is symmetric, the seller makes the same amount of money on average whether the auction type is English, Vickrey, Dutch, or sealed bid. What that means is that there is a symmetric equilibrium to the Dutch and sealed bid auctions, where the optimal bidding strategy is to bid what you think the next highest person's value is, given the belief that you have the highest value. This result was first established by Roger Meyerson. At a fundamental level, it is due to the fact that each bidder is focused on the ends, not the means. A bidder really only cares about how much he expects to pay and how likely he is to win the item. He can pay more to increase his chance of winning, and those with higher values for the object will do so. In a symmetric auction, everyone has the same beliefs about everyone else. For example, everyone might think that each bidder's value is equally likely to be anything between 0 and 100. In this case, whether the auction is Dutch or a sealed bid, you should bid what you expect the next highest bidder's value to be, given that all the other values are below your own. If your value is 60, you should bid 30 if there is only one other bidder. You should bid 40 if there are two other bidders, and 45 if there are three other bidders. In general, you would guess that the other bidders are equally spaced between you and zero. Thus, with one other bidder, that person is halfway to zero. With two other bidders, you expect them to be at 20 and 40. With three other bidders, you expect them to be at 15, 30, and 45. You bid at the expected value of the highest of your rivals. As the number of bidders increases, you can see that bids converge to valuations. As the number of bidders increases, the market approaches perfect competition, and all of the surplus goes to the seller. You can see that this would lead to revenue equivalence. In a Vickrey auction, the person with the highest value wins, but only pays the second highest bid, which is the second highest valuation. In a sealed bid auction, everyone bids what they think the second highest valuation is, given they are the highest. The person with the truly highest valuation will win, and the bid will be the same on average as the result in a Vickrey auction. The larger moral here is that you can write down a set of rules for a game, but the players can undo those rules. You can say that everyone has to pay twice their bid, but that will just lead people to bid half as much. You could say that people have to pay the square of their bids, but that will just lead people to square root what they would otherwise have done. That is ultimately what is going on in a sealed bid auction. You can tell people that they have to pay their bid rather than the second highest bid. In response, they'll change what they write down. Instead of bidding their true value, they will shade their bid downward to the point where it equals what they expect the second highest value to be. To see if you are a believer, try your new intuition out on the world's biggest auction, namely, the market for T-bills. Trip to the gym number 7. How much should you bid in a sealed bid auction? For simplicity, you can assume that there are only two bidders. You believe that the other bidder has a value that is equally likely to be anything between 0 and 100, and the other bidder has the same belief about you. T-bills. Each week, the U.S. Treasury holds an auction that determines the interest rate on the national debt, at least the part that comes due that week. Until the early 1990s, the way the auction worked was that the winning bidders paid their bids. After some prodding from Milton Friedman and other economists, the Treasury experimented with uniform pricing in 1992 and made the move permanent in 1998. The Secretary of the Treasury at the time was Larry Summers, a distinguished economist. We'll explain the difference between two cases through an example. Imagine that the Treasury had $100 million in notes to sell 1 week. There were 10 bids that came in at amount bid at interest rate, $10 million at 3.1%, cumulative amount, $10 million. Amount bid at interest rate, $20 million at 3.25%, cumulative amount, $30 million. $20 million at 3.33%, $50 million. $15 million at 3.5%, $65 million. $25 million at 3.6%, $90 million. $20 million at 3.72%, $110 million. $25 million at 3.75%, $135 million. $30 million at 3.8%, $165 million. $25 million at 3.82%, $190 million. The Treasury wants to pay the lowest interest rate possible. That means they will start by first accepting the lowest bids. Thus, all of the bidders who were willing to take 3.6% or below are winners, along with half of the bidders who were willing to take 3.72%. Under the old rule, the $10 million bid at 3.1% would win, and those bidders would get only 3.1% on their Treasury note. The $20 million bid at 3.25% would be awarded notes paying 3.25%, and so on all the way up to the $20 million bid at 3.72%. Note that there is more bid at 3.72% than can be fulfilled with the $100 million for sale, so that only half that amount will be sold and the other half will walk away empty-handed. Under the new rule, all of the bids between 3.1% and 3.6% are winning bids, as are half of those bidding 3.72%. With the uniform price rule, everyone gets the highest rate of any winning bid, in this case, 3.72%. Your first reaction might be to think that the uniform pricing rule is much worse for the government and better for investors. Instead of paying between 3.1% and 3.72%, the Treasury pays everyone 3.72%. Based on the numbers used in our example, you'd be correct. The problem with this analysis is that people won't bid the same way in the two auctions. We used the same number only to illustrate the mechanics of the auction. This is the game theory analog of Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there is a reaction. If you change the rules of the game, you must expect that players will bid differently. Let's take a simple example to drive this point home. Imagine that the Treasury had said that instead of getting the interest rate that you bid, you would get 1% less. So a bid of 3.1% would only pay 2.1%. Do you think that would change how much interest they would have to pay? If we stuck with the same 8 bids as above, the answer is yes, as the 3.1% becomes 2.1%, and the 3.25% becomes 2.25%, and so on. But under this new regime, anyone who had previously planned on bidding 3.1% would now bid 4.1%. Everyone would bid 1% higher, and after the Treasury adjustment, things would play out just as before. Indeed, this takes us to the second part of Newton's third law. For every action, there is a reaction, equal and opposite. That latter part may also apply to bidding, at least for the cases we've looked at. The reaction of the bidders offsets the changes in the rules. After bidders adjust their strategies, the Treasury should expect to pay the same interest rates using a uniform price rule as when winners get paid their bid. But life is much easier for bidders. A bidder who is willing to accept 3.33% no longer has to strategize about whether to bid 3.6% or 3.72%. If they value the bonds at 3.33%, they can bid 3.33% and know that if they win, they will get at least 3.33% and most likely something higher. The Treasury doesn't lose any money and bidders have a much simpler job. The Uniform Price Treasury Auction isn't exactly a Vickrey auction. The complication is that by bidding for more units, the bidder can lower the interest rate it gets on all of its winnings. This leads to some element of strategic bidding. To turn it into a multi-unit Vickrey auction, each bidder would have to receive the highest winning interest rate in the thought experiment where the bidder wasn't in the game. Many games that might not at first look like an auction turn out to be one. We turn now to look at two battle of wills, the preemption game and the war of attrition. In both contests, the situation is much like an auction. The preemption game. On August 3, 1993, Apple Computer launched the original Newton message. The Newton was more than a flop. It was an embarrassment. The handwriting recognition software developed by Soviet programmers didn't seem to understand English. In a Simpsons episode, the Newton misinterpreted "beat up Martin" as "eat up Martha." Doonesbury cartoons lampooned the mistakes made by its handwriting recognition. The Newton was scrapped 5 years later, on February 27, 1998. While Apple was busy failing, in March of 1996, Jeff Hawkins introduced the Palm Pilot 1000 handheld organizer, which quickly grew to $1 billion in annual sales. The Newton was a great idea, but it was not ready for prime time. That's the paradox. Wait until you're fully ready and miss the opportunity. Jump in too soon and fail. The launch of USA Today faced this same issue. Most countries have long-standing national newspapers. France has Le Monde and Le Figaro. England has The Times, The Observer, and The Guardian. Japan has the Asahi Shinbun and Yomiuri Shinbun. China has the People's Daily, and Russia has Pravda. India has The Times, The Hindu, Dainik Jagran, and some 60 others. Americans were alone in not having a national daily. They had national magazines, Time, Newsweek, and the weekly Christian Science Monitor, but no national daily paper. It was only in 1982 that Al Newhart persuaded Gannett's board to launch USA Today. Creating a national newspaper in the United States was a logistical nightmare. Newspaper distribution is inherently a local business. That meant USA Today would have to be printed at plants across the country. With the Internet, that would have been straightforward, but in 1982, the only practical option was satellite transmission. With color pages, USA Today was a bleeding-edge technology. Because we see those blue boxes nearly everywhere now, we tend to think that USA Today must have been a good idea. But just because something is successful today doesn't mean that it was worth the cost. It took Gannett 12 years before they broke even on the paper. Along the way, they lost over $1 billion, and that was when $1 billion was real money. If only Gannett had waited a few more years, the technology would have made their journey much easier. The problem was that the potential market for national papers in the United States was at most one. Newhart was worried that Knight Ridder would launch first, and then the window would be gone for good. Both Apple and USA Today are cases where companies were playing a preemption game. The first person to launch has a chance to own the market, provided they succeed. The question is when to pull the trigger. Pull too early and you will miss. Wait too long and you'll get beaten. The way we describe a preemption game suggests a duel, and that analogy is apt. If you fire too soon and miss, your rival will be able to advance and hit with certainty. But if you wait too long, you may end up dead without having fired a shot. We can model the duel as an auction. Think of the time to shoot as the bid. The person who bids lowest gets the first chance to shoot. The only problem with bidding low is that the chance of success also goes down. It might come as a surprise that both players will want to fire at the same time. That is to be expected when the two players have the same skill, but the result holds even when the two have different abilities. Imagine that it were otherwise. Say you were planning to wait until time 10 before shooting. Meanwhile, your rival was planning to shoot at 8. That pair of strategies can't be an equilibrium. Your rival should change his strategy. He can now wait until time 9.99 and thereby increase his chance of success without risking being shot first. Whoever plans to go first should wait until the moment before the rival is about to shoot. If waiting until time 10 really makes sense, you have to be willing to be shot at and hope your rival misses. That has to be every bit as good as jumping the gun and shooting first. The right time to fire is when your chance of success equals the rival's chance of failure. And since the chance of failure is 1 minus the chance of success, this implies that you fire the first moment when the two chances of success add up to 1. As you can see, if the two probabilities add up to 1 for you, they also add up to 1 for your rival. Thus, the time to shoot is the same for both players. You get to prove this in our trip to the gym. The way we modeled this game, both sides had correct understanding of the other side's chance of success. This might not always be true. We also assumed that the payoff from trying and failing was the same as the payoff from letting the other side go first and have it win. As they might say, sometimes it is better to have tried and lost than never to have tried at all. Trip to the gym number 8. Imagine that you and your rival both write down the time at which you will shoot. The chance of success at time T is P of T for you and Q of T for your rival. If the first shot hits, the game is over. If it misses, then the other person waits to the end and hits with certainty. When should you shoot? The War of Attrition. The opposite of the preemption game is a war of attrition. Instead of seeing who jumps in first, here the objective is to outlast your rival. Instead of who goes in first, the game is who gives in first. This, too, can be seen as an auction. Think of your bid as the time that you are willing to stay in the game and lose money. It is a bit of a strange auction in that all the participants end up paying their bid. The high bidder still wins. And here it may even make sense to bid more than your value. In 1986, British Satellite Broadcasting, BSB, won the official license to provide satellite TV to the English market. This had the potential to be one of the most valuable franchises in all of history. For years, English TV viewers were limited in their choices to the two BBC channels and ITV. Channel 4 brought the total to, you guessed it, 4. This was a country with 21 million households, high income, and plenty of rain. Moreover, unlike the United States, there was hardly any presence of cable TV. Less than 1% of homes subscribed to cable, and access to cable was limited by law to regions where on-air reception was unavailable. Thus, it was not at all unrealistic to imagine that the satellite TV franchise in the UK could bring in £2 billion revenue annually. Such untapped markets are few and far between. Everything was looking up for BSB until June 1988, when Rupert Murdoch decided to spoil the fun. Working with an old-fashioned Astra satellite positioned over the Netherlands, Murdoch was able to beam his 4 channels to England. Now the Brits could finally enjoy Dallas, and soon Baywatch. While the market might have seemed large enough for both Murdoch and BSB, the brutal competition between them destroyed all hopes for profit. They got into bidding wars over Hollywood movies and price wars over the cost of ad time. Because their broadcast technologies were incompatible, many people decided to wait and see who would win before investing in a dish. After a year of competition, the two firms had lost a combined £1.5 billion. This was entirely predictable. Murdoch well understood that BSB wasn't going to fold, and BSB's strategy was to see if they could drive Murdoch into bankruptcy. The reason both firms were willing to suffer such massive losses is that the prize for winning was so large. If either one managed to outlast the other, it would have all of the profits to itself. The fact that you may have already lost £600 million is irrelevant. You've lost that amount whether you continue to play or give up. The only question is whether the additional cost of hanging on is justified by the pot of gold to the winner. We can model this as an auction in which each side's bid is how long it will stay in the game, measured in terms of financial losses. The company that lasts longest wins. What makes this type of auction especially tricky is that there isn't any one best bidding strategy. If you think the other side is just about to fold, then you should always stay in another period. The reason you might think they are about to fold is because you think that they think you are going to stay in the game. As you can see, your bidding strategy all depends on what you think they are doing, which in turn depends on what they think you are doing. Of course, you don't actually know what they are doing. You have to decide in your head what they think you are up to. Because there's no consistency check, the two of you can each be overconfident about your ability to outlast the other. This can lead to massive overbidding or massive losses for both players. Our suggestion is that this is a dangerous game to play. Your best move is to work out a deal with the other player. That's just what Murdoch did. At the 11th hour, he formed a merger with BSB. The ability to withstand losses determined the split of the joint venture. And the fact that both firms were in danger of going under forced the government's hand in allowing the only two players to merge. There's a second moral to this game. Never bet against Murdoch. Case study: Spectrum Auctions. The mother of all auctions has been the sale of Spectrum for cell phone licenses. Between 1994 and 2005, the Federal Communications Commission raised over $40 billion. In England, an auction for 3G, third-generation, Spectrum raised an eye-popping £22.5 billion, making it the biggest single auction of all time. Unlike the traditional ascending bid auction, some of these auctions were more complicated because they allowed participants to simultaneously bid on several different licenses. In this case, we are going to give you a simplified version of the first U.S. Spectrum auction and ask that you develop a bidding strategy. We'll see how you do relative to the actual auction participants. In our stripped-down auction, there will be just two bidders, AT&T and MCI, and just two licenses, New York and L.A. Both firms are interested in both licenses, but there is only one of each. One way to run the auctions would be to sell the two licenses in sequence. First, New York, and then L.A. Or should it be first L.A. and then New York? There's no obvious answer as to which license should be sold first. Either way causes a problem. Say New York is sold first. AT&T might prefer L.A. to New York, but feel forced to bid on New York knowing that winning L.A. is far from certain. AT&T would rather end up with something than nothing. But having won New York, it may not then have the budget to bid on L.A. With help from some game theorists, the FCC developed an ingenious solution to this problem. They ran a simultaneous auction. Both New York and L.A. were up on the auction block at the same time. In effect, participants could call out their bids for either of the two licenses. If AT&T got outbid for L.A., it could either raise its offer on LA or move on to bid for New York. The simultaneous auction was over only when none of the bidders were willing to raise the price on any of the properties up for sale. In practice, the way this worked was that the bidding was divided up into rounds. Each round, players could raise or stay put. We illustrate how this works using the example below. At the end of round four, AT&T is the high bidder in New York, and MCI is the high bidder in LA. In the bidding for round five, AT&T could bid on LA, and MCI could choose to bid on New York. There's no point in AT&T bidding again on New York, as it is already the high bidder. Ditto for MCI and LA. Imagine that only AT&T bids. In that case, the new result might be AT&T bids 6 in New York and 9 in LA, MCI bids 5 in New York and 8 in LA. Now AT&T is the high bidder on both properties. It can't bid. But the auction isn't over yet. The auction only ends when neither party bids in a round. Since AT&T bid in the previous round, there must be at least one more round, and MCI will have a chance to bid. If MCI doesn't bid, the auction is over. Remember that AT&T can't bid. If MCI does bid, say 7 for New York, then the auction continues. In the round that follows, AT&T could bid for New York, and MCI would have another chance to top the bid in LA. The point of the above example was to make the rules of the auction clear. Now we will ask you to play the auction starting from scratch. To help you out, we'll share our market intelligence with you. The two firms spent millions of dollars preparing for the auction. As part of their preparation, they figured out both their own value for each of the licenses and what they thought their rivals might be. Here are the valuations. AT&T values New York at 10 and LA at 9. MCI values New York at 9 and LA at 8. According to the table above, AT&T values both licenses more than MCI. We want you to take this as a given. Furthermore, these valuations are known to both parties. AT&T not only knows its valuation, it knows MCI's numbers and knows that MCI knows AT&T's numbers and that MCI knows AT&T knows MCI's numbers and so on and so forth. Everyone knows everything. Of course, this is an extreme assumption, but the firms did spend a huge amount of money on what is called competitive intelligence. And so the fact that they had good knowledge about the other is pretty accurate. Now you know the rules of the auction and all the valuations. Let's play. Since we are gentlemen, we'll let you pick which side to take. You picked AT&T? That's the right choice. They have the highest valuations, so you certainly have the advantage in this game. If you didn't pick AT&T, would you mind picking again? It's time to place your bids. Please write them down. We've written our bid down, and you can trust us to have made our bids without looking at what you've written. Case discussion. Before revealing our bid, let's consider some options you may have tried. Did you bid 10 in New York and 9 for LA? If so, you've certainly won both auctions, but you've made no profit at all. This is one of the more subtle points about bidding in an auction. If you have to pay your bid, as you do in this case, then it makes little sense to bid your value. Think of this as akin to bidding $10 to win a $10 bill. The result is a wash. The potential confusion here is that it may seem as if there is an extra prize from winning the auction, separate from what you win. Or, if you think of the valuation numbers as maximum bids, but not what you really think the item is worth, then again you might be happy to win at a bid equal to your value. We don't want you to take either of these approaches. When we say your valuation is 10 for New York, what we mean by that is you are happy to walk away at 10 without whining or winning. At a price of 9.99, you would prefer to win, but only by a tiny amount. At a price of 10.01, you would prefer not to win, although the loss would be small. Taking this perspective into account, you can see that bidding 10 for New York and 9 for LA is actually a case of a weakly dominated strategy. With this strategy, you are guaranteed to end up with zero. This is your payoff whether you win or lose. Any strategy that gives you a chance of doing better than zero while never losing any money will weakly dominate the strategy of bidding 10 and 9 right off the bat. Perhaps you bid 9 in New York and 8 for LA. If so, you've certainly done better than bidding 10 and 9. Based on our bid, you'll win both auctions. We won't bid more than our valuations, so congratulations. How did you do? You made a profit of 1 in each city or 2 in total. The key question is whether you can do better. You obviously can't do better bidding 10 and 9. Nor can you do better repeating your bids of 9 and 8. What other strategies might you consider? Let's assume that you bid 5 and 5. The way the game will play out for other bids will be quite similar. Now it's time for us to reveal our bid. We started with 0, or no bid, in New York and 1 in LA. Given the way the first round of bidding has turned out, you are the high bidder in both cities. Thus, you can't bid this round, as there is no point in having you top your own bid. Since we are losing out in both cities, we will bid again. Think of the situation from our shoes. We can't go back home empty-handed to our CEO and say that we dropped out of the auction when the bids were at 5. We can only go home empty-handed if the prices have escalated to 9 and 8, so that it isn't worth our while to bid anymore. Thus, we'll raise our bid in LA to 6. Since we just outbid you, the auction is extended another period. Remember that the auction is extended another round whenever someone bids. What will you do? Imagine that you raise us in LA with a bid of 7. When it comes time for us to bid in the next round, we'll bid in New York this time with an offer of 6. We'd rather win New York at 6 than LA at 8. Of course, you can then outbid us back in New York. You can see where this is all headed. Depending on who bids when, you will win both licenses at prices of 9 or 10 in New York and 8 or 9 in LA. This is certainly no better than the result when you just started out with a bid of 9 in New York and 8 in LA. It doesn't appear that our experiment has led to any improvement in payoffs. That happens. As you try out different strategies, you can't expect them all to work. But was there something else you could have done that would have led to a profit greater than 2? Let's go back and replay the last auction. What else might you have done after we bid 6 for LA? Recall that at that time, you were the high bidder in New York at a price of 5. Actually, you could have done nothing. You could have stopped bidding. We had no interest in outbidding you in New York. We were plenty happy to win the LA license at a price of 6. The only reason we bid again is that we couldn't go away empty-handed, unless, of course, prices escalated to 9 and 8. If you had stopped bidding, the auction would have ended then and there. You would only have won just one license, New York at 5. Since you value that license at 10, this result is worth 5 to you. A big improvement over the gain of 2 you expect with bids of 9 and 8. Think again from our perspective. We know that we can't beat you in both licenses. You have a higher valuation than we do. We are more than happy to walk away with a single license at any price we can below 9 and 8. With all this practice, we should give you one last chance to bid and prove you really understand how this game works. Ready? Did you bid 1 in New York and 0 in LA? We hope so, because we bid 0 for New York and 1 for LA. At this point, we each have another chance to bid, as the bids from the previous round mean that the auction gets extended. You can't bid for New York, as you are already the high bidder. What about LA? Do you bid? We certainly hope not. We didn't bid. So if you didn't bid, the auction is over. Remember that the auction ends as soon as there is a round with no bids. If the auction ends at that point, you walk away with just one license, but at the bargain price of one, and thus you end up making nine. It may be frustrating to have us win the second license at one when you value it well above that level, and even more than we do. The following perspective might help soothe your spirits. Before we walk away with no license, we will bid all the way up to 9 and 8. If you intend to deny us any license, you have to be prepared to bid a total of 17. Right now, you have one license at a price of 1. Thus, the true cost of winning the second license is 16, which is well in excess of your value. You have a choice. You can win one license at a price of 1, or two licenses at a combined price of 17. Winning one is the better option. Just because you can beat us in both auctions doesn't mean that you should. At this point, we'll bet that you still have some questions. For example, how would you know that we would be bidding on LA and leave you the opportunity to bid on New York? In truth, you wouldn't. We were lucky the way things worked out in this case. But even if we had both bid on New York in the first round, it wouldn't have taken too long to sort things out. You might also be wondering if this is collusion. Strictly speaking, the answer is no. While it is true that the two firms both end up better off and the seller is the big loser, observe that neither party needs to make an agreement with the other. Each side is acting in its own best interest. MCI understands all on its own that it can't win both licenses in the auction. This is no surprise, as AT&T has higher values for each item. Thus, MCI will be happy to win either license. As for AT&T, it can appreciate that the true cost of the second license is the additional amount it will have to pay on both. Outbidding MCI on LA can raise the price in both LA and New York. The true cost of winning the second license is 16, more than its value. What we see here is often called tacit cooperation. Each of the two players in the game understands the long-run cost of bidding for two licenses and thus recognizes the advantage of winning one license on the cheap. If you were the seller, you would want to avoid this outcome. One approach is to sell the two licenses in sequence. Now, it wouldn't work for MCI to let AT&T get the New York license for one. The reason is that AT&T would still have every incentive to go after the LA license in the next auction. The key difference is that MCI can't go back and rebid in the New York auction, so AT&T has nothing to lose when bidding for the LA license. The larger lesson here is that when two games are combined into one, this creates an opportunity to employ strategies that go across the two games. When Fuji entered the U.S. film market, Kodak had the opportunity to respond in the United States or in Japan. While starting a price war in the United States would have been costly to Kodak, doing so in Japan was costly to Fuji and not to Kodak, who had little share in Japan. Thus, the interaction between multiple games played simultaneously creates opportunities for punishment and cooperation that might otherwise be impossible, at least without explicit collusion. Moral, if you don't like the game you are playing, look for the larger game. For more auction case studies, have a look at Chapter 14, The Safer Duel, The Risk of Winning, and What Price a Dollar? Chapter 11, Bargaining. A newly elected trade union leader went to his first tough bargaining session in the company boardroom. Nervous and intimidated by the setting, he blurted out his demand. "We want $10 an hour or else." "Or else what?" challenged the boss. The union leader replied, "$9.50." Few union leaders are so quick to back down, and bosses need the threat of Chinese competition, not their own power, to secure wage concessions. But the situation poses several important questions about the bargaining process. Will there be an agreement? Will it occur amicably or only after a strike? Who will concede and when? Who will get how much of the pie that is the object of the haggling? In Chapter 2, we sketched a simple story of the ultimatum game. The example illustrated the strategic principle of looking ahead and reasoning back. Many realities of the bargaining process were sacrificed in order to make that principle stand out. This chapter uses the same principle, but with more attention to issues that arise during bargaining in business, politics, and elsewhere. We begin by recapitulating the basic idea in the context of union management negotiation over wages. To look forward and reason backward, it helps to start at a fixed point in the future, so let us think of an enterprise with a natural conclusion, such as a hotel in a summer resort. The season lasts 101 days. Each day the hotel operates, it makes a profit of $1,000. At the beginning of the season, the employees' union confronts the management over wages. The union presents its demand. The management either accepts this or rejects it and returns the next day with a counteroffer. The hotel can open only after an agreement is reached. First, suppose bargaining has gone on for so long that, even if the next round leads to an agreement, the hotel can open for only the last day of the season. In theory, bargaining will not go on that long, but because of the logic of looking ahead and reasoning back, what actually happens is governed by a thought process that starts at this extreme. Suppose it is the union's turn to present its demand. At this point, the management should accept anything as being better than nothing, so the union can get away with the whole $1,000. Now look at the day before the last day of the season, when it is the management's turn to make an offer. It knows that the union can always reject this. Let the process go on to the last day and get $1,000. Therefore, the management cannot offer any less, and the union cannot do any better than get $1,000 on the last day, so the management need not offer any more on the day before. Therefore, the management's offer at this stage is clear. Of the $2,000 profit over the last 2 days, it asks half. Each side gets $500 per day. Next, let the reasoning move back one more day. By the same logic, the union will offer the management $1,000 and ask for $2,000. This gives the union $667 per day and the management $333. We show the full process in the following table. Each time the union makes an offer, it has an advantage, which stems from its ability to make the last all-or-nothing offer. But the advantage gets smaller as the number of rounds increases. At the start of a season 101 days long, the two sides' positions are almost identical, $505 versus $495. Almost the same division would emerge if the management were to make the last offer, or indeed, if there were no rigid rules like one offer a day, alternating offers, etc. The appendix to this chapter shows how this framework generalizes to include negotiations in which there is no predetermined last period. Our restrictions to alternating offers and a known finite horizon were simply devices to help us look ahead. They become innocuous when the time between offers is short and the bargaining horizon is long. In these cases, looking ahead and reasoning backward leads to a simple and appealing rule: split the total down the middle. There is a second prediction of the theory. The agreement will occur on the first day of the negotiation process. Because the two sides look ahead to predict the same outcome, there is no reason why they should fail to agree and jointly lose $1,000 a day. Not all instances of union management bargaining have such a happy beginning. Breakdowns in negotiations do occur. Strikes or lockouts happen, and settlements favor one side or the other. By refining our example and changing some of the premises, we can explain these facts. The handicap system in negotiations. One important element that determines how the pie will be split is each side's cost of waiting. Although both sides may lose an equal amount of profits, one party may have other alternatives that help partially recapture this loss. Suppose that the members of the union can earn $300 a day in outside activities while negotiations with the hotel management go on. Now, each time the management's turn comes, it must offer the union not only what the union could get a day later, but also at least $300 for the current day. The entries in our table shift in the union's favor. We show this in a new table. Once again, the agreement occurs at the season opening and without any strike, but the union does much better. This result can be seen as a natural modification of the principle of equal division, allowing for the possibility that the parties start the process with different handicaps, as in golf. The union starts at $300, the sum its members could earn on the outside. This leaves $700 to be negotiated, and the principal is to split it evenly, $350 for each side. The union gets $650, and the management only $350. In other circumstances, the management could have an advantage. For example, it might be able to operate the hotel using scabs while the negotiations with the union go on. But because those workers are less efficient or must be paid more, or because some guests are reluctant to cross the union's picket lines, the management's profit from such operation will be only $500 a day. Suppose the union members have no outside income possibilities. Once again, there will be an immediate settlement with the union without an actual strike. But the prospect of the scab operation will give the management an advantage in the negotiation, and it will get $750 a day, while the union gets $250. If the union members have an outside income possibility of $300, and the management can operate the hotel with a profit of $500 during negotiations, then only $200 remains free to be bargained over. They split that $200 evenly so that the management gets $600 and the union gets $400. The general idea is that the better a party can do by itself in the absence of an agreement, the larger its share of the bargaining pie will be. Measuring the pie. The first step in any negotiation is to measure the pie correctly. In the example just above, the two sides are not really negotiating over $1,000. If they reach an agreement, they can split $1,000 per day. But if they don't reach an agreement, then the union has a fallback of $300, and the management has a fallback of $500. Thus, an agreement only brings them an additional $200. In this case, the best way to think about the size of the pie is that it is $200. More generally, the size of the pie is measured by how much value is created when the two sides reach an agreement compared to when they don't. In the lingo of bargaining, the fallback numbers of $300 for the union and $500 for management are called BATNAs, a term coined by Roger Fisher and William Ury. It stands for Best Alternative to a Negotiated Agreement. You can also think that it stands for best alternative to no agreement. It is the best you can get if you don't reach an agreement with this party. Since everyone can get their BATNA without having to negotiate, the whole point of the negotiation is how much value can be created above and beyond the sum of their BATNAs. The best way to think about the pie is how much more value can be created beyond giving everyone his or her BATNA. This idea is both profound and deceptively simple. To see how easy it is to lose sight of BATNAs, consider the following bargaining problem adapted from a real-world case. Two companies, one in Dallas and one in San Francisco, were using the same New York-based lawyer. As a result of coordinating their schedules, the lawyer was able to fly New York-Houston, San Francisco-New York. A triangle route rather than make two separate trips. The one-way airfares were New York-Houston, $666. Houston-San Francisco, $909. San Francisco-New York, $1,243. total $2,818. The total cost of the trip was $2,818. Had the lawyer done each of the trips separately, the round-trip fare would have been just double the one-way fares, as there was no time to book the trip in advance. Our question considers how the two companies might negotiate the division of the airfare. We realize that the stakes are small here, but it is the principle we are looking for. The simplest approach would be to split the airfare in two, $1,409 to each of Houston and San Francisco. In response to such a proposal, you might well hear from Houston, "We have a problem." It would have been cheaper for Houston to have paid for the round trip to Houston all by itself. That fare is only twice $666, or $1,332. Houston would never agree to such a split. Another approach is to have Houston pay for the New York to Houston leg, to have San Francisco pay for the San Francisco to New York leg, and for the two to split the Houston to San Francisco leg. Under that approach, San Francisco would pay $1,697.50, and Houston would pay $1,120.50. The two companies could also agree to split the total costs proportionately, using the same ratio as their two round-trip fares. Under this plan, San Francisco would pay $1,835, about twice as much as Houston, who would pay $983. When faced with such a question, we tend to come up with ad hoc proposals, some of which are more reasonable than others. Our preferred approach is to start with the BATNA perspective and measure the pie. What will happen if the two companies can't agree? The fallback is that the lawyer would make two separate trips. In that case, the cost would be $1,332 to Houston and $2,486 to San Francisco, for a total of $3,818. Recall that the triangle route cost only $2,818. This is the key point. The extra cost of doing the two round trips over the triangle route is $1,000. That is the pie. The value of reaching an agreement is that it creates $1,000 in savings that is otherwise lost. Each of the two companies is equally valuable in reaching that agreement. Thus, to the extent that they are equally patient in the negotiations, we would expect them to split this amount evenly. Each party saves $500 over the round-trip fare. Houston pays $832, and San Francisco pays $1,986. You can see that this is a much lower number for Houston than any of the other approaches. It suggests that the division between two parties should not be based on the mileage or the relative airfares. Although the airfare to Houston is smaller, that doesn't mean they should end up with less of the savings. Remember, if they don't agree to the deal, the whole $1,000 is lost. We would like to think that this is a case where you might have started off with one of the alternative answers, but having seen how to apply BATNAs and thereby measure the pie correctly, you are persuaded that the new answer is the most equitable outcome. If you started right away with Houston paying $832 and San Francisco paying $1,986, hats off to you. It turns out that this approach to dividing costs can be traced back to the Talmud's principle of the divided cloth. In the negotiations we've looked at, the BATNAs were fixed. The union was able to get $300 and management $500. The round-trip airfares for New York, Houston, and New York-San Francisco were given exogenously. In other cases, the BATNAs are not fixed. That opens up the strategy of influencing the BATNAs. Generally speaking, you will want to raise your BATNA and lower the BATNA of the other side. Sometimes these two objectives will be in conflict. We now turn to this subject. This will hurt you more than it hurts me. When a strategic bargainer observes that a better outside opportunity translates into a better share in a bargain, he will look for strategic moves that improve his outside opportunities. Moreover, he will notice that what matters is his outside opportunity relative to that of his rival. He will do better in the bargaining even